The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there, this is Fred Brack from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, as it always is, and they have been serving the community since 1974, so I know you can trust them. Aside from the fact that Carter Glass is a personal friend, and I know you can trust him. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we're going to return to the January 2019 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. This is the warm winter escape month, and Biltmore's hidden jungle, rare orchids, is something we talked about last time. But, you know, every year they have a new series. It may last a whole year, it may last a half a year, whatever. And we just finished up the 1940s last month, and I was wondering what they were going to do this month. And this says, a new series, 1950s, a decade in motion. And this is written by Philip Gerard, as all of their special features like this hour are. And in 2019, author Philip Gerard explored the people and events that made the 1940s the decade of transformation. And this year, Gerard's stories about the 1950s showcase how ambitious individuals and a mobile populace shaped North Carolina for generations to come. This month, a preview of the decade influenced by social, technological, and political progress. By 1950, the war that defined the previous decade is just a painful memory. The boys have long since come home, and people are moving fast and optimistically toward a bright future. There's movement everywhere in the 1950s. On the highways, crowded with a parade of big, shiny automobiles with wraparound windshields and space-age tail fins, the Sunday drive now becomes a family outing with no particular destination. The trip itself an event, the automobile the new emblem of freedom and mobility. With gas rationing a thing of the past, the automobile comes into its own during the post-war boom. Three new national defense interstates, I-85, I-95, and I-40, take shape and advance into North Carolina. Hundreds of miles of fast, four-lane freeways. Simultaneously, the state undertakes an ambitious program to extend and modernize its farm-to-market roads. 12,000 miles of new roads are built, and another 15,000 miles are upgraded for all-weather travel. By mid-decade, these new highways support the fourth-largest trucking industry in the nation, home to more Class 1 motor carriers, that's tractor trailers, than any other state. Winston-Salem is home to the McLean Trucking Company, which advertises the largest individually owned trucking terminal in the world. And two new phenomena seem to bloom out of the landscape overnight. Drive-in movie theaters, such as the Moonglow Theater in Hendersonville and the Sunset Drive-in in Shelby, and drive-in restaurants like Short Sugar's Pit Barbecue in Reidsville. Unlike the chains springing up across the country, the local places tend to serve homegrown favorites. Families drive the new interstates and freshly paved back roads in sleek sedans and station wagons to park and eat, to park and watch, and the car itself becomes part of the entertainment. Automobiles bring tourists to the coast and the mountains. The auto vacation is the new luxury. Grandfather Mountain, privately owned by the Hugh McRae family, has long been a star attraction for tourists visiting the high country around Linville, Blowing Rock, Banner Elk, and Boone. Hugh Morton, McRae's grandson, inherits the property and begins working to make it more accessible, widening the road and building the most famous bridge in the state at its summit, a 228-foot-long suspension bridge popularly called the Mile High Swinging Bridge. Morton, a conservationist and accomplished photographer, acts as a steward of the property, preserving its natural features and documenting its breathtaking vistas in his photographs. His mother, Agnes McRae Morton, and Donald McDonald co-found the Highland Games and bring the annual event to the mountain, where it becomes a three-day celebration of Gaelic culture, featuring dancing, piping, and fiddling, sheepdog demonstrations and genealogy research, and competitions in traditional Scottish games such as the caber toss, the hammer throw, and wrestling. While the automobile is beginning to crowd out rail travel, for the time being, passengers can still enjoy a fast and luxurious ride on two rival carriers, the Atlantic Coast Line Railroad and the Seaboard Airline Railroad, aboard streamlined trains pulled by purple, silver, yellow, green, and orange locomotives with names like Champion and Orange Blossom Special. And Piedmont Airlines, which launches its first flight from Wilmington to Cincinnati just before the decade turns, offers city-to-city service on its fleet of sleek blue, silver, and white DC-3 aircraft. New Bern to Louisville, Asheville to Roanoke, and longer flights to Washington, D.C., and other big cities. On attractive land just north of Carolina Beach, stretching from the Cape Fear River across the peninsula to Myrtle Grove Sound, black families find entertainment and music. Segregation prohibits them from visiting white hotels and clubs. Besides the resort hotels on the water, more than 30 joints offer dancing to the hottest numbers on the jukebox. Some book live bands that play bebop, boogie, and swing music long into the night. While black and white audiences are separated by law, their music is not. Carolina Beach juke joint owners soon stock the so-called race records, and beach music takes hold among white teenagers, a crossover that sets the stage for rock and roll. They dance exuberantly on jukebox dance floors at Seabreeze and Carolina Beach, young couples, black and white, swinging to the hot new sounds of black entertainers like Amos Milburn, Chicken Shag Boogie, Paul Williams, the Hucklebuck, and Count Basie, 1 o'clock Boogie. Many of the decisive moments in the civil rights movement, which carries North Carolina inexorably into the future, play out during the 50s. In 1951, following a court order, the University of North Carolina opens its graduate and professional schools to black students. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court orders all public schools to segregate it, but in North Carolina, the legislature concocts the Pearsall Plan to moderate the process, declaring in a committee report, "The mixing of the races forthwith in the public schools throughout the state cannot be accomplished and should not be attempted." Doing so, the report said, would alienate public support to such an extent that they could not be operated successfully. Nonetheless, a handful of black students enroll in Charlotte, Greensboro, and Winston-Salem schools. Meanwhile, 7 black protesters occupy the white section of a Durham ice cream shop and are arrested. Black parents in Durham bring suit to allow their children to be admitted to the all-white high school. In February 1960, 2 years after the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivers an inspirational speech in Greensboro, racial tensions come to a head when 4 students from North Carolina Agriculture and Technical College stage a sit-in at the Woolworth's lunch counter there. And this effective form of protest is utilized by other activists across the South. This is the beginning, not the end, of the civil rights struggle in North Carolina. In the southwest corner, rather southeastern corner of the state, the Lumbee Indians have long sought recognition as an authentic tribe. Their origin is poorly documented, and some recognized tribes place doubts on the Lumbee's native descent, despite the findings of an anthropologist from the Smithsonian Institution who studies the tribe in the 1930s. He declares that they are of Siouan, Cheraw, and Kayawi origin, once known as the Croatan, after the Indians who lived on Roanoke Island when it was colonized by the English. In 1913, they are redesignated the Cherokee Indians of Robeson County. At last, in 1953, the state legislature recognizes them as Lumbee, the tribe's chosen name. The U.S. Congress confers its own recognition 3 years later, but also specifically denies the tribe any federal benefits. The Lumbee continue to suffer harassment, notably from the Ku Klux Klan. In 1958, led by wizard James Catfish Cole, the Klan stages a rally outside Maxton. More than 500 Lumbee Indians, many of them armed, descend on the rally and chase the Klan from the area in what becomes nationally famous as the Battle of Hayes Pond. The University of North Carolina has long sought to extend its educational mission across the state through the establishment of campuses and centers. Now it takes that vision to the airways. Through their visionary work of UNC's chief finance officer, William C. Billy Carmichael, Jr., Kay Kaiser, a renowned big band leader, and William C. Friday, WUNC-TV Channel 4 in Chapel Hill goes on the air, backed by a small appropriation from the legislature and $1.8 million raised from individuals, corporations, and foundations. Its inaugural broadcast on January 8, 1955, features freshman and varsity basketball games between UNC Chapel Hill and Wake Forest. Friday, assisted to the president of the consolidated UNC campus, hosts North Carolina People, which becomes the station's signature and longest-running show. WUNC broadcasts from a tower in Chatham County, producing content in three locations, a renovated laundry in Greensboro, a converted dining hall in Chapel Hill, and a newly constructed studio in Raleigh. A retrofitted Trailsway bus serves as a mobile studio. Friday himself becomes president of UNC in 1957 and remains true to his goal of expanding the broadcast reach to all 100 counties. In downtown Raleigh, the North Carolina Museum of Art opens on Morgan Street in 1956, occupying the former State Highway Division building. The museum is made possible by an astonishing act of cultural awareness. In 1947, the legislature appropriated $1 million to purchase 139 American and European artworks for the people of North Carolina, supplemented by 70 additional works purchased by the Samuel H. Kress Foundation. It's the first major collection in the country to be funded by a state government. With the scaling down of shipyards and other wartime industries, the state actively recruits new industry. Textile and tobacco are historically low-paying enterprises, and to prosper, North Carolina needs industries that can offer higher wages and attract educated young workers. The notion of a research center, partnered with leading universities, is first floated by Howard Odom, a UNC Chapel Hill sociologist, in 1952. An industry recruitment delegation representing the state, includes Romeo Guest, a builder and MIT graduate from Greensboro, who was inspired by the research corridor established along Boston's Route 128. A look at the map reveals a triangle of farmland and pine forest formed in the space between Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill, each point anchored by a major research university, and Guest coins the term research triangle. With leadership from the universities and business executives, by the end of 1959, the nonprofit Research Triangle Park is home to five companies, moving the state to the forefront of entrepreneurial innovation. W. Carr Scott wins election to the governorship at the turn of the decade with his slogan, Go Forward with Scott. In his inaugural address, he proposes using the state budget surplus to propel North Carolina towards transformational public improvements. By the end of his 4 years in office in 1953, he reports on just how much progress has gone forward. Many new schools and a statewide school health program, new hospitals and a more comprehensive public health program, 75,000 new telephone installations in rural areas, along with thousands more homes electrified. Thousands of miles of new paved secondary roads and modern deep water ports in Wilmington and Moorhead City. Carr is succeeded by William B. Umsted, who suffers a heart attack 2 days after his inauguration and dies in 1954. Lieutenant Governor Luther Hartwell Hodges, now chief executive, continues Carr's agenda and enthusiastically supports the creation of Research Triangle Park. Some of the movement of the 50s is retrograde as the struggle for civil rights ignites a backlash in the streets and in the legislature. But in general, North Carolina becomes a much more urbanized state, all of that movement to the cities, and the population grows even as out-migration increases, ambitious people taking advantage of their post-war freedom to seek better wages and more equitable working conditions in more progressive states. By decade's end, the state has reshaped itself on the foundation laid by the frenetic prosperity of the war years. It remains a work in progress, and that is its defining feature. Progress. Coming next month, juke joints help bridge racial divides. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. And now, Chilling on Middle Lane. A shared wall between two Beaufort hangouts is both a bulwark against the cold and a heartwarming reminder that in the off-season, coastal folks stick together. What's it like here in Beaufort in the dead of winter? I asked Jim Prest, the late innkeeper of the Langdon House Bed and Breakfast, the week of Thanksgiving long ago. At that moment, I had spent but one night in the town that has now, for the more than 30 years, been a second home to my family and me. I can tell you in a few words, Jim replied. Friends and the wind. Just friends and the wind. How often since then have I felt winter's power here, felt winds shift big and fast, heard the very cedars of this place shake and shiver, and thought of Jim and his clear, prescient words. Beaufort's streets, lined with cedar, sycamore, and live oak, receive a range of weather so forceful and changeable that the elements can seem almost spiteful on a winter's day. The sideways nor'easters, howling rains and mists will send townfolk and visitors alike streaming inside for protection of an evening, seeking an atmosphere of congeniality as vividly warm as the outside is nasty and raw. Middle Lane is one of the shortest streets in Beaufort, some 100 yards long, and even less than that from the Front Street docks on Taylor's Creek. Yet in the darkest winter, no place in this old port town is as lively and important a refuge and source of social sustenance as this brief street. Here sits a pair of cheek-by-jowl public houses, the funky, dimly lit back street and the bright and airy aqua, both presenting with little fanfare a rare and easy conviviality. When the stalwart Beaufortarian year-rounders and those who visit them in the midst of the undead winter gather in either of these symbiotic watering holes, they, like the places themselves, are sharing a common wall of warmth. Backstreet's home is a two-small-storied brick building that decades ago served as a bakery for Clausen's Grocery. The oven on an exterior wall and the fireplace in a corner just inside where flames are a flicker all winter attest to this place's long-running theme. Your mind would be blown by the amount of firewood I use in a winter, laughs Liz Kopf, genial owner of the Backstreet Pub for 18 years and counting. She left academia and a career of lobbying and political consulting to turn this small, venerable bar into something more, a warm and embracing de facto community center. Entranced by an Inishmore pub in Ireland's Aran Islands, where a child spun a top on the floor while his parents had a pint and a peat fire burned, Liz transported its essence to Beaufort. Beneath a ceiling hung with flags from faraway nations, a pair of long blonde skulls and faded orange life rings from boats named Contiki II and Bill of Rights. Liz speaks of the daytime folks who come here to play dominoes or scrabble over a pint or two and then go home, and of those who find their way to Backstreet at night, some staying on rather late. I made a sticker for them saying, I closed the Backstreet Pub. But my daytime crowd didn't take to that, so I made another set for them saying, I opened the Backstreet Pub. On Friday evenings during the wintertime, which Liz defines as September through May, a pot simmers near the stove, a free offering from all for all comers. I've gotten very good at making soup over the years, she says. Could be Italian black bean chili or vegetable soup. Regulars Mark and Kathy Schurtevan often make and bring in a chicken and artichoke soup. And on the last Friday of each chilly month, Liz even has a few bushels of oysters roasting, too. Music has always been a big draw. All manner of bands appear in the beer garden in summer, and during cold weather upstairs in the long-gone bakery's flower loft, I recall getting behind the keyboard there one winter's night, joining the band Unknown Tongues on the song 13 Miles to Merrimon, written by prize Carteret County singer-songwriter Connie Mason. The Down East band and its audience totally merged that night. Those singing along were no more than 3 feet away from fiddler accordionist Brian Blake and a frottoir bass-playing author Barbara Garrity Blake. Bands on the way to national recognition test their work and mettle at Backstreet. Ensembles such as Bombadil from Durham and Yarn from Brooklyn. And did I tell you the place is haunted? Lyd asks, adding yet another point of pride. How can I tell you? I ask. How can you tell? Excuse me, I ask. Mr. Clausen comes to visit us sometimes, she says. The large dial on the stereo moves. The volume goes up. Unusual noises come from the upstairs. Old boards creaking along the floor of the flower loft. She raises her gaze mysteriously toward the upper room and lets me imagine the spirit world on the move. Next door, with its blue bottle tree, rose bushes out front, and cool blue vases aglow in every window, Aqua Restaurant declares itself to be as idiosyncratically dressed as the Backstreet Pub and casual and funky. Inside, Aqua's mirrored world is a mélange of blackberry herb martinis and creme brulees. There's a catch of the day fish, tomato tarts, shrimp and grits, and craft brews from Kinston, Greensboro, and Asheville. One of Aqua's founding owners, Fred McCune, has called the spirit of the spot Dean Martin meets George Jetson. The big room's center section has the feel of a theater in the round, bespeaking its 90s past when before Aqua brought tapas and small plates to the Beaufort scene, this was a music venue. Fishtown Alley Performance Hall. Nowadays, a translucent aquamarine painting mounted on the ceiling shines above diners. Dazzling, backlit, and at least 8 feet in diameter, the hypnotic work creates the underwater effect. Guests look up as though gazing toward the water's surface as an abstract suggestion of a fish swirling in a circle above, wrought upon plexiglass by local artist John Masterson. Fondly known as Mother Aqua, the stylish and hardly matronly Kim Kromka has managed the bistro for 11 of its 15 years, greeting guests as old friends while instructing her youthful staff like a choreographer. "I'm happy to have that moniker," Kim says, "because it's all about the wonderful, invigorating young people who come here to work and who pass through. It's just a terrific neighborhood that gathers here." Most nights, Aqua is socially a swirl, with folks drifting from the short bar and table hopping. The whole place is informal, spirited, and alive as a New York Theater District bistro. Beaufort shopkeepers gather with teachers and artists, one of whom is among the top photographers in the South. Another is a fine modernist composer. Another a celebrated marine science teacher who was chosen a few years ago to join a National Geographic expedition to Antarctica. Designers and boat builders wander in from the Jarrett Bay boatyards just up the intercoastal waterway to meet up with some of the most widely traveled sailors in the American East. One of them walks through the off-season crowd asking folks to come see him in St. Thomas and sail the Sir Francis Drake Channel with him and his wife. A deep red wall frames the mirror behind the bar, flanked by Miro and Calder prints. Blue art glasses all around. Kim stands amid all of this color, watching the creations of veteran chef Jason Foster go by. Our catch, grouper trigger mahi, is our most popular dish. People love our lamb, small plate. People love our filet, small plate. And they adore the bento box, which comes back in the winter. Aqua's twice-monthly four-pour wine tastings stay on the restaurant's calendar through the cold months as well. Next door, Liz smiles at the notion of folks dropping in at Backstreet for a beer and a few salty oysters before drifting over to Aqua for a meal. Kim feels the same way. "I go fetch people from over at Backstreet when their dinner reservations at Aqua come up," she says. The cross-pollination between this pair of hangouts has clearly long bemused the two women who keep the heart of Beaufort beating. The great aviator Beryl Markham once wrote of our deep human need for such gathering places. A Claridge's in London or a pub, a Ciro's in Paris or a bistro, alehouse, coffeehouse, bodega, caravansary, by any name, each is a sanctuary, a temple for talk and for the observance of the warming rites of comradeship. If you'd like to visit them, the Backstreet Pub is at 124 Middle Lane in Beaufort. Website, thebackstreetpub.com. And the Aqua Restaurant is at 114 Middle Lane, guess that's right next door, in Beaufort. And they are aquaexperience.com. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I certainly hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios at 919-832-5138. But for now, so long until next time.